Welcome back to McKinsey on China. I'm Glenn Leibowitz. China has been the biggest economic growth story of the past two decades. But as growth cools, the government and the business sector are taking a harder look at what it will take for China to sustain the levels of job creation and income growth it needs to make the transition to a consumption-led economy. In this podcast, Nick Leung talks to Jonathan Wetzel, Gordon Orr, and Yogang Chen about a new report by the McKinsey Global Institute that takes a close look at economic growth and productivity, both globally as well as in China. Jonathan is a senior partner who leads MGI in Asia. Gordon is a senior partner in Shanghai. Yogang is a partner who leads MGI in China. Nick is managing partner of McKinsey's Greater China practice.
So today we're talking about growth and growth in China specifically. To join us in this, we have our growth experts from the Global Institute. We have Jonathan Wetzel, head of the Global Institute. We have Yogang Chen, head of the Global Institute in China. And of course, we have our in-house guru, Gordon Orr, who's joining the conversation. And what we'll start off with, Jonathan, is perhaps if you could describe a piece of research that you've just completed about global growth, looking across the entire world.
Sure. Well, the McKinsey Global Institute has just come out with this report on global growth and productivity, which examines the relationship between growth, employment, and productivity. And what we find is that over the last 50 years, from 1964 to 2014, global growth has averaged around 3.5%. And roughly half of that came from labor growth, and the other half came from productivity growth.
When you say labor growth, you're talking about also participation rates, I guess.
We're talking about both aging and demographics, so the number of people of working age, and the rate at which they've participated in the economy. So it's the product of those adds up to the employment. And we've seen that that has grown by roughly 1.5% every year for the last 50 years. That plus an average of 1.5% of productivity growth gave us global growth of around 3.5%. So that's kind of where we've been, is this incredible growth story.
But Jonathan, was this really not anything more than people just being healthier and shifting from working on the farm to working in the factory, and particularly in China in the last 30 years, surely almost all of that global growth is people in China moving from the farm to the factory.
It's a big portion. I don't think it's the majority, but it's a significant contributor. And yeah, absolutely, those big shifts in terms of quality of healthcare, there's arguably a technology innovation around public health, as well as urbanization and how that enables industrial specialization. Those are the things that actually translate into productivity growth. So, I mean, if we wanted to decompose productivity into what drove that, I would certainly say urbanization, public health, those would be two of the most important factors.
And if you rewind the clock to 100, 200 years ago, basically what you're saying is that we shouldn't take those things for granted, that in those days you weren't getting improvements in longevity, you were not getting improvements in the number of people in the workforce,
right,
nor their productivity.
We've had thousands of years of relatively slow technology and productivity growth, as well as for a long time there, we were stuck in this trap where the global population basically didn't grow, and that any incremental returns that we were getting were simply going into preserving life as opposed to growing it. We crossed over a certain boundary about 150, 200 years ago, where all of that technology and productivity growth enabled us to create a surplus, which in turn resulted in people actually living longer. And I think that's a really interesting question for the demographers. It's sort of like what turned the corner on that. But what we did see was an explosion in population growth rates starting about 100 years ago.
So we shouldn't take the last 50 years for granted, and they have been benign in that sense. Now, what makes you think it's going to be different going forward?
As people get richer, they live longer, but they have fewer babies. And so we're approaching a dramatic sort of peak both in terms of aging and in terms of labor force participation. We have had significant increases in labor force participation rates in the past, and we're at the point in many countries where the upsides from increasing that are less available. Now, that's last one, that participation rate forecast is probably the trickiest part of this. So the big driver here is simply people are not having as many babies, and as a result, the total population of the world is within forecastable range. We see a peak.
So what you're saying is that these things are foreseeable, and based on our projections, we don't think that either the number of people or the participation rate of people, so the total number of people in the workforce, be it through growth of the number of people absolutely or those participating, will increase. And therefore, the only lever left remains productivity then?
Yeah, that's essentially what's happening is that we are going to have a peak in the rate of growth of the labor force. And as a result, if we want to have the same level of economic growth as we've had for the last 50 years, something has to change with the other variable. The other variable is productivity. So as employment rates drop, productivity has to go up. And in fact, if we assumed that there would be no increase in productivity, in other words, we held productivity growth at the same rate as we had in the last 50 years, going forward, that means our total growth would drop by about 40%. And that would change people's expectations. It would change people's expectations of what their children could earn. It would change people's expectations of their ability to consume. It would change people's expectations of what their governments can deliver.
China has a good news, bad news thing on that, really, right, Jonathan? Because there's so many parts of the Chinese economy that despite, you know, the fantastic growth that we've had over the last 30 years, are still remarkably low productivity, whether it's, I think you highlighted the automotive industry. You know, we all have our own favorites, whether it's the banking industry or insurance, many service sectors. And then, you know, the government itself, I mean, it's very easy to point finger at the government and say, look, you know, you've got to become, you know, fundamentally more productive yourself over the next 10, 20 years to free up labor to work in other parts of the economy and to facilitate economic activity.
Yeah, I think that this good news, bad news is, you know, in a sense, we always say that there is an upside because China has, you know, clearly some ways to go before it approaches OECD levels of productivity. That said, China has a model. It has a way of doing things, which is perhaps not efficient, but it's quite effective. And, you know, and changing any kind of model requires a lot of decision-making and requires new ways of thinking and new ways of approaching. It often usually requires new players. So there's a big incumbency challenge here. And that's where I think the debate in China is all about.
I mean, sometimes it boggles my brain to think about how many hundreds of millions of people are going to need to develop a new set of skills to transition to roles, jobs that require higher productivity and, frankly, for these jobs to exist successfully.
So the global thesis is pretty clear. The question we wanted to ask, of course, is can China grow?
Well, the model that Jonathan described is a very classic model. So a lot of the factors are also universal, right? And thus applicable to China as well. So, for example, on the input side, on both capital and labor, there's an economic and also natural limitation to how far China can grow further. So just take population, for example. China has recently relaxed the one-child policy, but the reality is most people, having taken a hiatus of, you know, 2 decades or 3 decades, most people, most of the population have decided not to have the second kid. So the application for second child is actually much lower than the original estimation. So again, a lot of these global factors will also apply to China. But I think the difference here is really China is still in a very imperfect market economy situation, right? So the system with which in which all these factors are put into actually has still a lot of significant room for improvement. So the market economy premium or the reform premium would actually create a lot of growth opportunities on top of the natural growth room that you would typically see in a more developed market.
So basically, back to Jonathan's thesis here, which is the number of people who are working and how productive they are. Participation rates in China can increase, but not as much as they have in the past. The population we know is not going to grow. And so you're left with productivity, right? And I think you guys have thought quite carefully then about which parts of the economy have the biggest productivity gains. If you had to say, you know, the places where it's most available and most interesting. And Gordon, you covered them just a minute ago as well, in areas you said around healthcare, around services, around government, etc. So is it pretty much everywhere then?
I think if you take, you know, even agriculture, for example, right? I think the recent government policy towards liberalizing trade with, you know, a few of the agricultural countries, for example, Australia, has clearly demonstrated a commitment and belief that China really needs to, you know, deploy its resource in the most productive way. So therefore, for dairy products, for maybe some of the meat products, and other agriculture products included, China is very open to actually import versus, you know, having to protect the local industry. Whereas the local resource, be it land resource or other financial resource, can actually be diverted into more productive industries that China has a more a stronger natural endowment. So I think the overall direction of the reform in agriculture and also in others will continue to create a lot of additional room for growth. I think retail, despite the fact that e-commerce is already 10% of total Chinese retail, but I think the impact, right, not necessarily only from e-commerce itself, but the impact e-commerce has had in, reshaping the overall distribution in China and therefore pushing the physical stores to also improve its productivity still has a long room to go. I think if you look at the clothing stores, for example, in China, the apparel stores in China, Uniqlo in China is growing very, very rapidly, despite the fact that a lot of its sourcing is actually from China. So the Chinese sort of retailers still have to get their acts together in terms of really consolidating purchasing, getting their sourcing efficient, and really competing with global class retailers. And, you still have to remember that 95% of China's total retail sales is still driven by local retailers. So from that universe, there's still a lot of efficiencies to be gained. And obviously, this will also in turn generate a lot of consumer surplus, which could also then indirectly benefit other industries as well.
The auto industry. I mean, it's clear we still, I think a good friend wants to refer to the Chinese industry as having like 3 wild horses, 7 donkeys, and, 65, ponies out in the grasslands. There's just a whole lot of...
These are the players in the
old players in the old, in the industry. There was some agricultural metaphor to frame it. But the net is that there are still a tremendously long tail of local, small manufacturing facilities, which are supported by local governments, because in their local context, those are not so bad jobs. But the reality is that those factories are very inefficient, and they could be and will be consolidated, and doing so will drive industry productivity to a globally competitive level. And that is, I think, a big lever when it comes to looking at the whole manufacturing sector globally. In fact, it's a surprisingly large number to think about, and it does translate into a lot of benefits for the supply chain, sort of the component manufacturers, as well as the distribution and marketing of automotive vehicles. So I feel like it has tremendous upsides both for the industry as well as the employment associated with it, and ultimately for the consumer. And rationalization, though, also requires a change in the economic model for local governments, and that many of them...
Exactly. I mean, the structure of the industry is like that for a reason, as you say. And therefore, unless you believe that the reasons to consolidate and improve productivity are stronger, or those forces are stronger than the forces which are, keeping the structure the way it is today, it won't happen, right? And so...
All right. I think you're pointing to... pressure. And I think this is what we've seen in other things, consumer electronics or elsewhere.
Consumer choice, price pressure. Yes.
In China, to recognize the auto industry is still a very protected industry in China. Some of the higher import tariffs in the world, which accounts for the profitability of these manufacturers. So it's just the point at which government says, okay, it's time to take the gloves off and get back to normal Chinese competition, which is where it takes 2 companies to make a price war. And yes. We have hundreds of them, so it won't be too hard to see what's going to happen here.
Indeed.
Well, I think the agriculture one is a tricky one, of course, because there's always going to be this push off the fields issue. Sort of, if we mechanize the farms, and China kind of today is at the stage of replacing one family with one tractor. So every tractor we put in sends another family somewhere, and then
they've got to do something in those ever more productive factories, which are also being not automated.
Right,
in the cities.
And they're actually not going to the factories; they're going to go to the barber shops and the road crews and the maid services. That's where they're going to go, and which is okay, but where's the ladder from that to becoming a middle class consumer in an urban life, and having an urban life, having your own apartment, having ownership of some type of financial asset. I mean, this is the transition which China's going through, and where I would be looking at for most of the upside is in the services sector, and it's also what affects the most people, both in terms of employment and as consumers.
But if we step back from that, I think what you're saying essentially is also the question is how fast China wants to grow, or how fast that growth can be tolerated because of the externalities and some of the knock-on effects that will happen there, which will have social and other implications, which are profound.
Well, there's a big debate about inequality. It's probably the hottest topic. I'm saying, does growth necessarily require inequality? When we go globally to Thomas Piketty's arguments about capital, or we have a view of Larry Summers on secular stagnation, saying inevitably there's this divide between the haves and the have-nots. And as we grow, the rich keep getting richer and the poor get poorer. Is that a necessary consequence of accelerating productivity growth? I think there's the jury is very much out as far as the theory goes. In terms of the practice, we have seen, of course, in China a dramatic rise in the Gini coefficient, both at the national level and actually within the urban environment itself. So it's not enough just to say that the urban and the rural are separating. In fact, within cities itself, there's a greater gap between rich and poor. So what is to be done about that? Is that a sustainable model? I think it's a really interesting question. It's a debate for Chinese society. I feel Chinese society has a uniquely community-based approach to development in many ways. And so that trust, that community feeling is being stretched.
Well, I think culturally, Chinese people are much more, you know, concerned about upward mobility rather than equality, right? So on this side, I think it's a culture very inducive to growth rather than, you know, too much worry on already achieving a lot of equity during that process. But again, coming back to the sort of the growth point that Johnson, you were talking about, I think the fact that the SME financing has become a top agenda for the government, right? A lot of these policy changes would actually encourage a lot of entrepreneurism, including but not exclusive to the service sector. That's going to provide a lot of employment opportunity as well, as we see displacement from agriculture, as we see the displacement from less productive industries. So I think the overall, you know, the reform direction, again, the reform premium, although it was very much a rhetoric, you know, back 6 months ago, I think a lot of the government actions have proven this to be quite genuine.
One of the things I'm sort of interested in this course of development is that, like, say what we like about infrastructure spending, it is a public good. And so in many ways, the product of a lot of this has been goods and services that are available to the whole population, whether Correct. It's a road or it's a sewer system or it's a hospital. These are things that are available to everybody. And as a result, the benefits of economic growth have been available to everybody. In the next wave of growth, that's going to be less of what we spend the money on. It's going to be more driven by individual consumers and their particular desires and their access to capital. And as a result, the benefits of that growth may not be as directly available to the majority of society. And how the rich, therefore, choose to give access to those opportunities will, I think, Yogang, become a real question. I think people in China do get upset if they feel that their children are not going to get access to the same opportunities as the children of rich people.
Okay, but getting back to growth then, I suppose your thesis is the question being, can China grow? The answer is absolutely, because of the lever remaining being productivity, essentially being abundantly available to China across multiple sectors and multiple activities. The question really is that reform agenda and how quickly it can be addressed, because some of the externalities resulting from it are fundamental. And so the question is not, can China grow, but how fast does China want to grow?
I think that's right. I think it's, can China grow and at what cost? And there is a transaction cost to growth. There is clearly externalities, whether it's about the use of resources or the impact on the changes of societies, that needs to be addressed. It's a sort of a pay now or pay later kind of thing.
Right. But the short-term question that people are addressing, which is, you know, what the evergreen question of, is there going to be a hard landing? And I'm not quite sure why we always use this airline analogy, but Li Keqiang's remarks about the growth this year, a lot of that essentially is predicated on the investment model and whether or not the investment model is running out of steam. And essentially, the thesis here is to say, well, yes, the investment model is probably yesterday's game, that the next wave of growth, though abundantly available, will be different and potentially also harder.
It is right. And I think it's a question of people are looking at the wrong metrics. We know that the incremental capital output ratios have been dropping for a decade now. It's not a question. And we know that savings rates are going to decline, and we know that investment rates are going to decline. That isn't the issue. The issue is productivity growth. At what level is that productivity growth happening, and how to measure it, and how to encourage it?
So your answer to the question, can China grow, is yes, but does it want to?
Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. To download this report for free, visit our website at www.mckinseychina.com.